The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lane.
If you look at the three most basic things that we need as people to survive, it's food, it's energy, and it's housing. To incentivize people to invest in those three things and to provide those services to the population, the government gives really generous tax breaks to farmers, to energy companies, and to us, to real estate investors. And one of the really big breaks that we get is called a 1031 exchange. If you're not familiar with what that is, it's basically a way that you can sell a property, and if you have a nice gain on that property, as long as you keep that money invested in real estate and you buy another property, the government isn't going to make you pay taxes. Now, there's a lot of little gotchas. There's a lot of little things to understand, and it can be very complicated. So on the show today, I wanted to bring on an expert on 1031 exchanges to explain it in a very easy to understand way so that we can figure out how we can use the 1031 exchange to build wealth and to continue to build our rental portfolio. Joining us on the podcast today from Dallas is Brendan Lewis. We'll take a really quick break. We'll thank our sponsors. We'll come right back and we'll meet Brendan. The first step in buying a rental property is to get pre-qualified. And I would suggest you work with a lender that specializes in working with investors, because the last thing you want to have happen is to get to closing and find out the money's not there and you can't close. The lender that I recommend is Chaley Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. She's a nationwide lender, and she'll pre-qualify you for free if you mention Rental Income Podcast. Find out more today. Contact Chaley at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E, lendinggroup.com. NMLS 42056. When I'm doing research to buy a new rental property, there's a lot of different websites, apps, and then a spreadsheet that I use to do my analysis. It's really kind of a convoluted process. Well, there's a much easier way. There's an app called Ask Rick. That's R-I-C for Rental Income Calculator. Ask Rick makes it really easy to find and analyze rental properties. You can see all the properties for sale in an area. If something looks good, you can press one button. It'll analyze the property for you. It'll figure out the rent amount. It'll figure out your mortgage payment, all your expenses, and give you your cash flow. If you're ready to move forward, you can make an offer right there on the app, or you can send the information over to your realtor to do some more investigation into the property. You can try it out for free right now. Just search for Ask Rick. That's R-I-C, Ask Rick in the App Store, or go to justaskrick.com. That's justaskrick.com. I don't want to confuse anybody here at the very beginning, so why don't we start at a real high level explaining how the 1031 works?
Yeah, absolutely. So 1031 exchange, this is a concept that that originated. It's been in the tax code for pretty much 100 years. And it originated as a way for originally for farmers to have non-recognition of their capital gains when they would effectively sell a piece of land and purchase another one. They felt like you know, they needed to be made whole as a result of that. They shouldn't have to pay capital gains just by, you know, moving that over. So fast forward to today, it's still in use for that purpose, but we see it used a lot for investment purposes as well. It comes from Section 1031 of the tax code, and which states that you can exchange a investment property, a business use property, a property for use in a trade, and exchange that into something else, and you would have non-recognition of gain so long as you have that continuity of investment.
Okay, and I know it gets a little bit confusing, like there's a lot of technicalities, but would you say it's kind of like when an investor is getting a mortgage, like where when you get a mortgage, you don't have to be an expert on everything to do with mortgages. It's good to have a little bit of an understanding, but your loan officer is really going to be the expert. Is it kind of the same thing with a 1031?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when it comes to the taxpayers themselves that you know, come to us as a qualified intermediary or real estate brokers or whoever they might be, you really have to just, you don't have to have a you know, complete understanding of this. That's what we're here for. And, you know, and working with people, CPAs and brokers if necessary. Okay. But yeah, absolutely.
So the biggest thing from the research that I've done with the 1031 is that you don't want to receive money when you sell a property, that is, as soon as you receive money, your 1031 is over. You're paying taxes. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's two things that can happen there. I get a lot of folks who come to me and they'll say, you know, I just closed on my, you know, rental home that I was selling, and I'm ready to do a 1031 exchange. And the qualified intermediary who facilitates the exchange has to step in on behalf of the taxpayer before the closing. And there's actually an assignment that occurs, but anyway, they have to step in before the closing so that the seller in a 1031 exchange does not have actual or constructive receipt of funds.
Okay.
And the minute that happens, then unfortunately you expose yourself to the taxes that
so
are applicable.
At that point, you're paying taxes on your gains. You're repaying all the depreciation. You're just basically done at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So when would somebody, the qualified intermediary, which is what your company does,
correct,
that is like someone that you would want to engage, like as soon as you list the property or before you list the property, like when would you find someone to help you?
You know, I think this is one of those things where I think if you invest in real estate, it doesn't matter if you own one rental property or, you know, or 10, I think it's a concept that you should be aware of and a strategy that you should, you know, keep in the back of your mind. Know that when the sale of investment property becomes a sort of a topic of conversation, where either you're thinking of doing it or you've engaged your agent or broker in selling it, that's really where you should start having a conversation.
Okay.
You know, that kind of advanced planning in any situation is recommended. We can, of course, facilitate a forward exchange quite easily, even a couple hours before, you know, going to the closing table, but it really would be recommended to do it in advance.
Okay. All right. There's a couple of things in the rules that just seem a little bit confusing to me, and I want to see if you can clear these up. So after you sell the property, you have to identify three properties that you may want to buy. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's the identification period. So the first 45 days after close are there to identify properties for the replacement portion of the exchange. So you can do that in three ways. And I always, as you know, when I present this to people in a visual format, they're listed in an order. And I always say that they're listed from most common to least common. And the first one is what you just mentioned, which is the three property rule. So that's basically, you know, without getting too much into the weeds, it's three, you can identify three properties of any value. And then if you wanted to identify more than three properties, which sometimes happens, you can take advantage of the 200% rule, which allows you to identify any number of properties so long as you don't exceed 200% of what you've relinquished. And then the third option is if you want to identify more than 200% of, you know, value, then you can move to the 95% rule. And that says you can identify any number of properties, any value, but you have to essentially close on all of the properties that you've identified, or 95% of the value of what you've identified.
Wow.
So not really very commonly used. Mostly you're going to see the three property rule, maybe 200% rule. But that's as part of the 45 day identification.
So these wouldn't necessarily be properties that you have under contract. They're properties that you're looking at or that might be good candidates?
Yeah, exactly. So this would be, you don't have to be under contract on them. You don't have to have submitted an offer. These are properties that just, it's really just a way to document that this is what you're looking at. And, you know, within that 45-day period, those identifications can be revoked and replaced and whatever you need to do. But beyond it, you are locked into those properties. So, the idea is that you would perform on one, two, or all of them.
Okay. So, and that's 45 days after closing on the property you're selling.
Correct. And we call that the relinquished property.
And then what happens next? Like, how long do you have to actually close on the replacement property?
So you have a total of 180 days, and that's including the first 45 days of identification. You know, the average exchange is somewhere around, you know, between 60 and 90 days. But I often see people close, you know, identify and close within that identification period of that first 45 days. But you have a total of 180 to complete the exchange.
And what happens if you don't meet one or both of the deadlines? Can you get an extension? Is there a way to figure something out?
So there's no extensions that are given. The only instance of that is if there's a natural disaster, and this has to be something that is a, you know, government issued type of a thing, where we just recently did have one as a result of COVID, where they did push the identification period for, you know, they allowed that to be extended, but typically it's really uncommon for that to occur.
This is really serious. I mean, when you get into a 1031, you've got to really have your ducks in a row, because that clock is ticking as soon as you sell that first property.
Yeah, right? And I would say that, you know, most of my clients that I talk to, you know, it seems like it's not a long time that you have to act, but you know, it normally is adequate for residential type rental properties. But yes, you do have to really adhere to those timelines. And if you don't, to your question, you know, if you don't identify any properties at the end of 45 days, the exchange is sort of null. So your funds would be returned to you if you've identified nothing.
Okay.
And if you've identified three properties within that period of time and you don't act on those, you know, you're not able to close on any of them, then the funds have to be held until the end of the 180 days and then they're returned to you.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, the other thing,
there is no penalty for not completing an exchange. That's some people have that sort of misconception.
Okay. No penalty, but you still have to pay all the taxes.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Yeah. All right, now clarify for me what it means when it says you have to buy a property of equal or greater value. I just want to make sure I have my head around that.
Yeah, so some folks will come to me and they'll say, you know, I'm going to sell you know, my rental property that I've had for 10 years, and you know, I'm selling it for $500,000. I owe $100,000 on it. So I'm going to buy something for $400,000. And that would not fly, because you have to purchase something of equal or greater value. So it's not about proceeds. It's about the sale price.
Okay.
You know, there's certain allowable expenses that can be backed out of that, but, and I don't want to go too far into that, but things like real estate commissions and closing costs, those can be subtracted. But you have to purchase something of equal or greater value, and that kind of covers your basis. So if you're talking about an all cash deal, it works. And if you're talking about a property that's, you know, equity and partially leveraged, you're also going to accomplish that by buying something of equal or greater value.
Okay. So you've got to keep the same amount of leverage. So if it's a $400,000 property, you have $200,000 in equity, a $200,000 loan, you've got to at least have a $200,000 loan on the place you're buying.
Correct. There's two things that you can do. You can balance the equities and the debt on the replacement property, or you can add cash into the deal to supplement the, if you don't want to take out a loan, or maybe somebody who doesn't, they won't qualify for a loan, or they can supplement that with cash.
Okay. And you could also supplement it with a bigger loan, right?
Yes. Not to take out cash. You can't, do a cash out refi, but to purchase, to buy up. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Let me hit you with a couple of different scenarios that people might run into and see if we can understand this. So what if you want to buy multiple properties? Like maybe you're buying a property that's appreciated a ton, and maybe you want to buy 7 properties with the proceeds from that one property you're selling. Is that possible?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've had clients over the years, one of them, a gal sold a property in California, and took that, you know, it was $1 million and took that and went to Idaho and purchased, 6 or 7 rental properties. And you can absolutely do that.
Okay.
It can be done within one exchange. It's absolutely possible.
How about the other way around? That maybe I have 20 properties and I want to sell them all and I want to buy a Walgreens. Is that possible?
Yeah, it is possible. That's what I would call consolidation. It's very common when it comes to people, you know, if they've got 20 properties they're managing, or their, you know, property managers are managing, it can be a little bit much. So that consolidation it's possible. It's tricky because in your example of 20 closings, I mean, you've got 20 properties closing. The timeline on the 45 days and the exchange as a whole begins on the first closing. So when you're relinquishing multiple properties, it becomes a bit of a challenge. Replacing multiple properties, much easier.
That's a good point. So yeah, it's almost like if you're selling multiple properties, it might be easier if you can find one buyer, like if you can sell it to another investor and sell your entire portfolio.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. I've had several folks over the years who have sold a portfolio of, 5 or 6 homes to one individual, that absolutely makes it easier. Okay. if you have one buyer.
Right. Okay. Now, what if I want to take some cash out? Like maybe I have $1 million in gains. I want to put $750,000 into a new property, but I want to hold on to $250,000. Is that possible, or does the whole thing have to go into the new property?
So you've got two options at that point. There is such a thing as a partial deferral. So if you wanted some cash out, but you also wanted to reinvest, you could do a partial deferral where you would pay taxes essentially on the portion, that you've taken out.
Awesome.
So if there, and that's one way of going. The other way would be if you sell that property, reinvest all the proceeds, match the debt and the equity. And then if there isn't any debt, then you have the option, you can refinance after the exchange is finished, completed. You can refinance and, at that point, take money out and it won't affect the exchange.
That's a really good point. I want to make sure everyone understands that. So if you roll the money over to the new property and you want to access it right away or at some point in the future, there's no exclusion on doing a cash out refi and taking money out of the new property.
Right? Yeah, at that point, the exchange is complete. From the IRS's point of view, you're solid at that point. You really would just want to, your only limitations would be lender,
right,
limitations there. So if you had a significant amount of equity and you had maybe a little bit of debt on the property and you had just closed, the lender might say, absolutely you can pull out more cash, but we're going to make you wait 6 months.
Sure. Okay. That makes sense. What about LLCs? Like, what if I own properties in multiple LLCs, or like, does that complicate things? Is it possible? Like, how does that work?
It isn't. It is. It it Yes and no. It can complicate things to the extent if they are multi-member LLCs, where maybe one of the members wants to exchange and the other one doesn't. But if they're single member LLCs and if they're disregarded entities, then it's no different than the individual taxpayer at that point. So, those disregarded entities are sort of flowing up to the taxpayer. And they are the ones who can, you know, purchase a new property either under, you know, you have different options. So if you've got ABC LLC that you're selling a property, sole member, disregarded entity, and you want to sell that and either put it into another entity, single member, disregarded under you, or in your individual name, you can do that.
Okay.
If there's multiple people involved and they're in it, you know, multiple members, then likely that entity is the tax paying entity.
So what if you have a partner and maybe your partner wants out, they want to take their money out, but you want to keep your portion and roll it into another property? Is that possible or?
It is possible. It's what we refer to in the industry as a drop and swap. If there's one entity that has two members, and let's say you and I own a property and you want to reinvest, but I don't. So the options there is now interest. We have interest in the entity, but that's interest in a partnership or in an entity are not like kind. So, and they cannot be exchanged. So if we wanted to go our separate ways, we'd have to move sort of outside of that entity, that structure, drop out of it and either go into our individual names or new entities where we are, you know, where they're disregarded, and then proceed with an exchange.
Okay.
So that now we're tenants in common, we have a specific interest in that property and we can do an exchange.
Okay. What about state lines? Like maybe if I own properties in California, I want to buy properties in Kentucky. Is there any complication when you're crossing state lines?
No, for the most part, you are free to buy and sell in any of the 50 states. The only complication that can occur is there are several states, California being one of them, where if you've sold a property in California and you move those exchange funds to another state and purchase something, California is a clawback state. And so while you will not have to, you know, you'll defer your federal taxes, you will defer the state taxes that would be due, and any other applicable taxes. But if you were to ever sell that property down the line, let's say I moved from California and moved to Texas and I bought property. If I sold those properties in Texas, California, and I didn't reinvest in a new exchange, you know, deal, then California is going to want their state taxes back.
Okay. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the end game. So at some point you may not want to do this anymore. Let's talk about some ways that this could end. That number one, I guess if you just decide you want to get out of real estate, you want to sell everything, you want to liquidate, at some point you're going to have to pay everything back, right?
Yeah. I mean, all of those bases, all the, you know, those calculations over the years, if you've done several exchanges, will need to be taken into account. But, you know, the idea is that you have been also making money on those properties, mm-hmm. you know, at an ordinary income rate, throughout the time that you've, you know, owned them. But yes, you would have to pay taxes at that point.
Now, let's talk about a few ways to get out of that. So the first one that I want to see if this is possible. So there's an exclusion if you own a primary residence where you can you don't have to pay taxes on $250,000 or $500,000 if you're married. Is there a way to combine the 1031 exchange? Maybe you have a whole bunch of gains that you've built up over the years. Is there a way to buy a property and live in that property and then not have to pay back anything?
So there is, and that would be called like what I would call a split treatment. So you're using Section 121, which is what you just referred to, and Section 1031. So, you know, I've had clients over the years who will purchase a property, let's say in Florida somewhere, and they rent it out for, you know, however many years. You need to rent it out for a minimum of 2 years. You know, if you ask 10 CPAs, you're going to get 10 different answers on that. But I would say a minimum of 2 years. And at that point you can move into the property after that. So I have a lot of folks who will buy a property in Florida. They know that maybe they want to retire there at some point. They'll rent it out, and then later on down the line, they'll move into it. If that becomes their primary residence, now they've been able to take advantage of Section 1031, the deferral of the capital gains tax. And now it's become their primary residence, their homestead. And they can take advantage of Section 121.
Incredible. I mean, that is a great, just an incredible way to build wealth, that you can buy rental properties over all these years, eventually roll that into a primary residence, and then you've got up to $500,000 if you're married, tax free. That's really incredible.
It's something that, you know, it's also done in the reverse. You know, there are folks who will turn their primary residence into a rental property. That's probably not as common, but it does mm-hmm. happen. And then it could be turned back into a primary residence at a later time.
Yep.
There's going to be a little bit of, you know, if it does have that split treatment upon the sale, they're going to consider things like, you know, the depreciation recapture. If it ever was a rental property, the IRS is going to want to have sort of part of that tax, but it's not, you're not looking at what it, you know, the worst case scenario, which is that you sell it and you've got to pay all the taxes.
Okay.
There.
Yeah. All right. Now, eventually we're all going to die. So what happens when you die? Does your estate have to pay everything back, or does it go away? Like how does this all end?
Yeah. So, you know, we have terms or sayings in the industry. One of them is swap until you drop, or kick the can until you kick the can. You know, it's 1031 exchange has really been a tremendous estate planning tool for years. And so you can accumulate, you know, over the years, there's no limit to the number of times you can do an exchange. You can just continue deferring that gain indefinitely. And so when an individual passes away, and their heirs will receive a step up in basis to essentially the value of at the time when the person had passed away. And so all of those gains that would have been taxed are sort of forgiven in a sense, because the basis is now calculated differently than it was before.
Wow. So if you have accumulated $10 million in gains over your lifetime, when you die, your family would inherit that tax-free?
Well, I can't say tax-free, because, you know, there might be inheritance tax and things like that that would apply. But in terms of capital gains on that real estate, I mean, you know, from those exchanges, yes.
That is awesome.
It would be tax-free.
Brandon, you are awesome. I mean, you are really an expert on this. I've learned so much talking to you. This has been really incredible. If anybody is interested in learning more about a 1031, or they want to reach out, and if they have questions, what's the best way for someone to reach you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, first of all. I can be reached. My email address is Brendan, B-R-E-N-D-A-N. L as in Lewis, at accruit.com. Company's called Accruit, and we're at accruit.com. We've got quite a bit of content there, blog posts, and some really great information for folks who want to learn more about 1031 tax deferred exchange.
If you missed that, or you want to look it up later on, I've got a link to Brendan's contact information on my website. You can find it at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode 269. I'm sure you know this already, but I just want to put it out there that Brendan is not a CPA. He's not a tax professional, and the tax law can be very complicated. So make sure you talk to your own tax professional before you do anything. the purpose of this interview is really just to kind of give you the basics and to get you thinking. I'd like to thank today's sponsor for making this episode possible. It's Chailey Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. If you're looking to buy a rental property, whether it's your very first rental or you want to add to your portfolio, the lender that I recommend is Chailey Ridge. She's a nationwide lender, and she specializes in helping investors buy rental properties. She has a ton of different loan programs, and whatever you're trying to do, whatever you want to accomplish with your rental properties, Chailey can help you put together a plan and get you the financing that you need to get there. If you want to find out more or set up a time to talk to Chailey personally, just go to ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E, lendinggroup.com. If you mention Rental Income Podcast, she will waive all the pre-qualification fees. NMLS 42056. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. If this is your first time here, make sure you subscribe. We have new interviews every single Tuesday. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.